Fun fact, Bob Ross actually hand-painted each individual frame of this movie. This is housekeeping.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Seen and Heard.
Hi.
This is the podcast where two entertainment assistants go through the Sight and Sound Top 100 Greatest Films of All Time list. I'm Greg. I'm joined by my co-host, Jackie.
Hello.
And we're here this week to do a special episode for two reasons. First of all, this movie is not, unfortunately, sadly, this movie is not on the Sight and Sound list at all. So this is part of our Personal Prince series, which is a series we do every once in a while where we pick a film that's not on the list that are special to either one of us or both of us. This week, it was my turn to pick the film, and I've picked Bill Forsyth's Housekeeping from 1987, starring Christine Lottie, who will be joining us in the second half of this episode.
What?
Yes, I know.
No way.
Get ready. So yes, in the second half of this episode, we will have a nice, comfortable interview with Christine Lottie talking about the film. So stay tuned for that halfway point where she will come on and offer all sorts of great insight into the making of the film.
Why did you say comfortable?
I know. I don't know. What's...
Like, Greg is really nervous.
I'm like such a bad host. You know what I mean?
No,
like,
you're not. You're just really nervous to have Christine on.
I'm nervous. Yeah, sure. I am a little nervous. Because I love this movie so much, and her performance in this is just so incredible.
So incredible.
Very excited to talk to her. So,
me
yes.
too.
Until then, let's just get into the film. So Jackie and I are going to dig in, get our hands dirty. This is 1987, Bill Forsyth's Housekeeping.
Housekeeping was released in 1987. It was written and directed by Bill Forsyth, based on a novel by the same name by Marilyn Robinson. Cinematography by Michael Coulter. His credits are amazing, by the way.
Yeah, I know.
Notting Hill, Sense and Sensibility, Love Actually, Four Weddings and a Funeral. Every British movie I love, essentially.
There was an interview with him on the disc and he was talking about it. Yeah, I was like, shit.
Anyway. In 1950s Idaho, two little girls, Lucille and Ruthie, are orphaned when their mother commits suicide. After 7 years of being cared for by their grandmother in the family home, Grandma passes away and their long-lost aunt, Sylvie, is contacted to come care for the children. The girls quickly learn their Aunt Sylvie is no ordinary woman. Although loving, she is chronically strange, collecting massive amounts of newspapers, saving tin cans for no explicable reason, and often spending her days wandering about the town or in the nearby woods. As the girls grow, Lucille decides she wants nothing to do with her odd family and prefers the company of fashionable, normal people in their small town. However, the snooping townspeople feel Sylvie is unfit to raise Ruthie, pestering her and forcing Sylvie to be put on trial. Sylvie and Ruthie decide their best bet is to set the house on fire and run away, freeing themselves of the constraints of their backwater community and their legacy as the town freaks forever. The film stars Christine Lottie as Sylvie, Sarah Walker as Ruth, and Andrea Burchill as Lucille. The film was shot on location in Alberta and British Columbia in Canada. So Bill Forsyth is Scottish, and this was his first film made in North America. And originally, Diane Keaton was set to star as Sylvie, but she pulled out 6 weeks prior to shooting, which caused a lot of funding issues. David Putnam, who was the head of production at Columbia, succeeded in getting it funded eventually, even after Diane Keaton dropped out. However, he was fired from Columbia after the film had been shot, so the studio was like really reluctant to pay for the film's promotion. So it did go under the radar, unfortunately. Never had a US DVD or Blu-ray distribution, but in the UK, Powerhouse Films released a Blu-ray in 2017.
Yeah, yeah.
The film did go to the Tokyo International Film Festival, though. It won the Screenplay Award, the Special Jury Prize, Christine Lottie was nominated for the New York Film Critics Circle Award for Best Actress. And critics really like this movie. It's just that people didn't really see it. Roger Ebert famously loved this film and was a champion for the film. He hosted a special screening at his annual film festival, Ebert Fest, years later, and had a Q&A. So I'm excited to talk to Christine about that. I really am. But yeah, that's Housekeeping. It's such a, it's a small little lovely movie that I wish more people have seen.
Yeah, same. You talked about, do you know what movie Diane Keaton left to do instead?
Let me think. 87?
I'll give you a hint. Sam Shepard.
I don't know.
Baby Boom.
What's that?
It's this like rom-com with her. And it's like where she's a new...
Sam Shepard?
Yeah, well, he's in it. Yeah, so... She's like a New York businesswoman and she moves to Vermont to live this like rural, cozy life. And then she falls in love with country boy, Sam Shepard.
Sam Shepard.
But yeah, Diane's lost too because, you know, again, great actress, but this, you know, this is the role.
And our gain for seeing Christine. Our gain.
Exactly. Exactly.
So what are your initial thoughts, Greg? You really love this movie. And I know you, like Ebert, are a champion of this movie.
Yeah. Well, as much as I try to be. So... Yeah, I first saw this because a friend of mine, Sue, who was a close friend and creative partner, recommended this movie to me. And I saw it maybe a year after she recommended it, which is bad. But I finally saw it and was just floored by it, of its like quiet beauty. And this was my first Bill Forsyth movie. I've since seen Local Hero, which is the movie, I think two films before this, which actually Criterion has a disc of. This movie stuck with me so much. And again, like I saw it and it was such a like tsunami in my head, but I couldn't talk to anybody about it.
Yeah.
And I was like to friends and, you know, colleagues like, oh, housekeeping. I'm like, no, sorry, I haven't seen it. So it's like, oh, God. Okay. So it's like kind of keeping it to myself. But the movie made such a profound impact on me that it led me to read the book. And again, I'm kind of embarrassed of, you know, I'm not a super up-to-date reader. Like, I could read a lot more than I am. I should be reading a lot more than I am, especially as a writer. But most of my time is spent watching movies. But I was so compelled by the film to seek out the book, which is written in 1980, written by Marilynne Robinson, who won the Pulitzer Prize for her 2004 book, Gilead, which I also got. I got a couple of her books because I love the movie so much. Mm-hmm. I was just like, oh, I just want to read like what she has to offer. So I read the book. And the book is incredible. The book is really special and magical. Her prose is just like on another level. Like, yeah. It's kind of indescribable how delicate and beautiful the book is put together.
You can just tell by the narration in this movie.
Yeah, exactly. So the narration in the film, it's just snippets that were lifted from
exactly
the book.
Exactly what I thought.
So Bill Forsyth, I know when he made the film, his intention was just to like, work almost like a workmanlike approach. Like he just wanted to translate the book to film. He didn't want to spin it a different way. He didn't want to put his own thing in there. His literal goal is like, I just want to lift up what I can from the book and drop it into the film.
I saw some quote by him where it was like, oh, I want to make a trailer for the book.
Yes.
Like that's how he described this movie.
He's even said too, he's like, oh, if you have the choice, like to see the movie or read the book, like go read the book. But no, the book is fantastic. So I've since seen the movie a couple times. I've read the book and what a beautiful world. I'm obsessed with this world. I love the world of Fingerbone and these sisters and Sylvie and this, just in this house. Like I'm obsessed with the world. And I know we've talked about this before in terms of like, we watch movies to live other lifetimes or just to spend time in a place that you love. Mm-hmm. And for me, so much of Housekeeping is like, I love this world and I love being in it for as long as I can. So the book was a pure joy to read. And yeah, I love this film. I think what's so cool about it is Bill Forsyth is one of those directors, like he's a very gentle touch. And I think again, like there are a lot of flashier filmmakers out there. And I think sometimes he kind of gets overlooked. But his contribution to film is really significant, especially in the 70s and 80s. And his career kind of tapered out in the 90s. But and again, like watching interviews with him, he's a very soft-spoken, you know, Scottish guy, which is, he's great. But that comes through in his films, and his films are very gentle.
Yeah.
And almost like when the first time I saw Housekeeping, it snuck up on me in the best possible way. Like, it started, and you're like, okay, and you're in it. And at a certain point in the film, I just realized I was like in love with it. And it wasn't at the beginning. It was somewhere kind of in the middle, I think. I think it was when Sylvie takes Ruth to the woods.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the boating trip. That was the moment I was like, oh my God, like there's something else going on here that's really interesting and it's really quiet and observed. I know Bill Forsyth talks about like when he translated the book to screen, he hoped that some of the quiet magic of the book would just like find its way into the film. And I think it absolutely does. And I think it's kind of an indescribable quality of the movie. So yes, I love the film. Since I've seen it, I've been telling everyone I know to watch it. And I love this movie and I love the book. I love everything about this. It's a very special movie to me. I think Christine Lottie's performance especially is just like one of the greats. Like her performance in this is so nuanced and she's just giving you, she's giving you so much in such a subtle way. And she walks this really fine line between like, yeah, sure, she's not super well, right? Like, but she's so likable. And I found myself, every time I see it, I find myself sympathizing with her character and being like, yeah, of course, like that's the right decision.
Of
like,
course.
Even though when you take a step
Are you not supposed to sympathize with the character?
No. You are. But again, like on paper, her character's a little crazy, right?
See, I don't think she is. Like,
I don't want to say crazy. I just, in terms of like...
I absolutely think it's the best thing for Ruthie. We're going to get into this. I absolutely think it's the best thing for Ruthie to be in the care of Sylvie. Like, and there's so many movies about like custody battles where you're like, yeah, I sympathize, but really... And the beauty of those movies are like, you know that it's not the right thing.
Right.
But with this one, I think it's the right thing.
Yeah, I think so too. I just think... Because too, if she was taken away from Sylvie, she would be in the foster care system because her, the rest of her, like her aunts,
or she could just be adopted by the home ec teacher, apparently.
Oh, true. Yeah, that's true.
Maybe she can get adopted by the English teacher and then they could.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. But my point is Christine Lottie like makes the character so, because in the book, again, I came to the book after having seen the film. So the whole time I read the book, I was just imagining Christine Lottie in the book. So I already had that benefit. But like, I feel like if I had read the book first, I think a lot of the warmth that Christine Lottie gives off in the film is not necessarily so much in the book. Like that's a performance thing. So that's kind of what I'm saying of like, she gives it this perfect balance of like, it's just perfect. It's a great performance. It's a truly great performance. And of course, the two sisters are amateur actors. This is like their first thing. I don't even know that either of them has done much afterwards.
I don't think they did.
It's interesting. I want to ask Christine about this because Bill Forsyth has called her basically a co-director of the film.
Wow.
Because she stepped in and really, again, I think he kind of has a more passive directorial style. And she stepped in and really coached like the two girls and stuff in the movie. So he's called her a co-director.
That's great.
So I would like to ask her about that. But yeah, I love this movie. I think it's a beautiful, it's like a warm hug. But it's also got this strain of something very unsettling running through it.
Yes.
From the family history to Fingerbone, there's kind of this creepiness to the whole thing. And it's just enough. And I think that's what makes it really special. Instead of just being like this, oh, it's cozy, like almost like a Gilmore Girls-esque thing. It has this creepiness, which gives it another layer.
Yes.
So I love this movie.
Yes.
Anyway, this was your first time, right?
Yeah.
Let's hear it.
Again, shocked that I haven't seen it because I live for these movies. So like, can we just bring back these heartfelt yet not corny book adaptations that are centered around women? Like it started from like 1985 and went all the way to like the 2000s. There was like Cider House Rules, I guess, in like 2001. But you know what I'm talking about, right? Yeah. Like it's like Terms of Endearment, Steel Magnolias, Practical Magic, which is very similar because they go to live with their aunt.
I think the last one we had was Greta Gerwig's Little Women.
Yes. Yeah. Beaches was another
Beaches,
one. Like there's so many. There's so many.
Mermaids?
Mermaids, yes. Yeah. I forgot Mermaids, but yes. And they're all based on books and they're all like about women and their families, and I want them back. I want to bring back this movie. So I'm very glad I saw this because this is a great example of that. And yeah, like you said, I love how quiet this movie is. Like I'm obsessed with how quiet this movie is, with so much happening and so much tragedy in it. I think it's magical, and it's definitely like Christine Lottie is super responsible for that. Like she is that.
Yeah.
And I'll get more into it. These are just my initial thoughts. The narration is so good. It really, I even made a note right here. It seems like someone just went through the book and chose the best lines.
That's what he did.
And they're put in at the perfect moment, perfect moments. It never felt unnecessary. I love the way they're even read. Like, I love the way that the Ruthie actress is reading them.
Yeah, because when did narration become a bad word? It's funny because we're both writers, and that's like, it's like a bad word when you go and take writing classes. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, don't use narration. It's cheap.
It's cheating.
Like, I've never felt that.
I love narration.
Unless you really have, like, there's a rare instance where, like, if you haven't filmed what you need to film, or there's like a logical gap in the story and you can tell narration comes in just to tie things together. You can feel that.
Well, here's the
thing. But narration like this, that's just giving you context and history and, like,
yes,
feeling.
But in this movie, there are a few moments like that where, like, sequences are skipped and it's just like Ruthie telling us about it, but it doesn't feel wrong. It's like when when Lucille is accused of, like, wrongfully cheating and had to stand up in front of the whole school, we don't see that.
Yeah.
We just hear her tell us about it. And, like, that is what people warn against. Like, only use narration if it's going to add to the story, add to the feelings. We don't want to hear it. We want to see it. You know, that's what they say. But I don't have a problem with it in this movie at all.
A scene like that of her standing in front of the class might have been too much, too. Like, it wouldn't have fit with the film. Like, it's too big.
Yeah. And then also, like, the night that she leaves, it's like, oh, she went to go spend it with the home ec teacher. And then they talked all night and things like that,
right,
where she is telling the story. And it's probably a perspective thing. But then again, like, Ruth is at school, too. But I don't have a problem with it. I don't have a problem
with it. Well, yeah, because Lucille, because it's all the movie and the book are told from Ruth's perspective.
Yes.
And Lucille. So I think it makes sense that Ruth is, like, filling in on what happened with Lucille and the home ec teacher.
So I even wanted more. Like, at the very, very last scene, I was kind of waiting for, like, one more piece of narration. But those are my initial thoughts. Let's talk. I think our first talking point just has to be how quiet this movie is.
Yeah. Well, and it's not just from an audio perspective, too.
It's
like
the
lights are always off in the house, and there's just this kind of understated quality to the whole thing. Even again, when the mother drives off,
suicide, the opening of the movie,
treated very calmly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The suicide, which is obviously horrible, opening of the movie, boat ride to the little island. Like, how quiet is that? How great is that? And it has to do with the setting, of course, the town of Fingerbone. They're surrounded by nature. They're surrounded by this kind of
beautiful,
serene atmosphere.
Beautiful. Do you love the Pacific Northwest?
I've never thought about it, honestly.
I think about it all the time.
Do you really?
Yeah.
I never do, to be completely honest.
I love that stuff. I love that, like,
forest.
Like, Fingerbone is paradise to me.
Then you miss the point of the movie.
I'm talking about from a, you know, like,
okay, there's this great place called Lake Arrowhead. It's only about 2 hours from
Lake
here.
Lake Arrowhead has nothing on Fingerbone, okay?
I'm joking. It's beautiful, though. Like, I'm
Arrowhead
fine with
is
going
so dry.
What do you mean?
Arrowhead is dry and the lake smells bad. It smells like sulfur.
Okay. Well, anyway, and even not even just the setting. So it is the setting, of course, but it's also just the fact that they're surrounded by old people growing up, and they show you that scene of, like, a boring get together, and that's what their life was. That woman snoring. I love the line, the old man, where he's like, oh, do you have your silver coin to show them? He's like, it's in my other pants. Yeah. I love that.
They're just running down the list of all the things that he could show them
exactly,
to keep them entertained.
Exactly. And it's like, the movie does this interesting thing where it's like, yes, it's very quiet, but then it plays with danger, obviously. And, like, the boat scene, the ending, like, the tension in both those scenes is there. The boat scene more.
Yeah.
There's so much tension and it's built up, but it dissipates, like, so naturally. It just it just takes Sylvie saying, don't worry, nothing's gonna happen.
Yes.
And it dissipates so calmly. Nothing happens in either case. Even in the end, she's like, what if a train comes? Don't worry. And they run and the movie ends.
Yeah.
I love even when she's leaving the morning, the first night she stays there and they think that she's running away. It's the next morning and she's walking to town. And Ruthie says, like, don't worry, it'll be all right. And Lucille says, I know it'll be all right, but it makes me mad. And I feel like that's the whole movie.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
It really is. It's like even these moments of danger are treated with such a quiet calmness. And I think that's why a lot of people call this movie eerie.
Right.
Except the score. The score
is beautiful.
But it's eerie. It's kind of creepy.
It's Michael Gibbs.
But don't you think that the score doesn't really match this whole, like, quiet setting we're talking about?
No, it does. It's a very quiet, delicate score, but it's slightly off.
Weird,
it's slightly
yeah.
offbeat.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
in terms of, yeah, no, that's what I love about it.
Yeah.
Because I think in a lesser film, the score would have been a little bit bubblier.
Yes. It would have been like Steel Magnolias.
Pave over some of that stuff. Yeah, yeah. Again, not to throw Steel Magnolias under the bus, but actually, you know, it's been a long time since I've seen it. I'm not going to stand up for that now. I'll stand up for Terms of Endearment, though. But yeah. There's the music does add this slightly otherworldly quality.
Yes. And of course, this all feeds off of and corresponds to Sylvie herself. This right. whole like quietness of the movie is her. She's not Auntie Mame. She's not Mary Poppins. You know, like mm-hmm. when you hear about this movie and you hear about like it's about these orphan girls who go and live with their unusual aunt, you think Auntie Mame.
Yeah.
Or Mary even Poppins. Like Practical Magic. Yeah. Yeah. Like Practical Magic. Oh, they're witches, you know?
Yeah. The movie and the book resist that every step of the way.
So great. But she is like calm, collected, mellow. She's a hippie. She's just a calm hippie who's minding her own business.
Yeah.
And I love it. I absolutely love it. She's not bombastic. She doesn't have to spread her weirdness, which is also another thing I love, you
right.
know, like she doesn't lecture the girls about like when Lucille's asking her about her husband, she has fun with it. Like she doesn't tell them like, girls, you know, like you don't have to get married. It's not like she's never obvious,
right.
which is so great. She doesn't, when she sees that ad for the, she goes in to this like hardware store, not hardware, like household appliances.
For the fridge, yeah.
The fridge, the ad that's yeah. like super silly housewifey. Like,
make your wife happy by
buying a
fridge.
She just looks at it and laughs, which is beautiful. She doesn't roll her eyes. She doesn't make a comment.
She laughs.
She just laughs.
At the shop owner's face too.
But
and then he
kind
of rolls his eyes.
Yeah,
it's great.
It's perfect.
I love too this movie. So this movie encapsulates loneliness. And we've talked about loneliness in films before and how they're definitely something that I respond to. I think we both do. But I think that's the key theme here because Sylvie is such a lonely person. It's this kind of sadness. It's this need for companionship.
Mm-hmm.
But aww. It's done in this really beautiful way
yeah.
of everyone. Like the two girls and Sylvie, all they're looking for is companionship.
Yeah.
The girls are looking for a paternal figure
mm-hmm.
and she's looking for friends.
Yeah.
You know, she calls Ruthie like the sister she never had.
Yeah.
So,
well, that goes into the whole like family legacy thing, which I would love to talk about. Should we talk about it now?
Yeah, let's do it. So we start
the
movie.
Like,
yeah, go ahead.
There's this really complex affinity towards family. And I think it is because of loneliness. What you're saying, it's like, Sylvie says that Ruth reminds her of her dad and also her mom. And yet, like, they constantly remind us that the older you get, the less you remember dead family members. And she even says, like, I don't even remember my dad, but I know that that's him.
Mm-hmm.
So it's this really interesting, complex thing about, like, yeah, it's good to have family, but also it's flipped with, like, Lucille, who needs family. She needs companionship, and yet she willingly leaves them.
She needs structure. She needs more structure than she's getting.
But that's why I love it so complex. It's not
yeah.
just telling you like, yes, family is the answer. It's
right.
just this really complex thing.
Right. Because for each of the sisters, like it's two different things. Like
yeah.
for Lucille, she needs that structure. She needs the discipline there.
Mm-hmm.
They stay out, they skip school all day in the hopes that when they come home, Sylvie will scold them.
And
she doesn't.
I love the one line. It's like Sylvie's reaction to our truancy was insufficient or something. Do you remember?
Yeah.
It's so funny.
Yeah.
I love that. But yeah, Lucille feels no bond towards them, whereas Sylvie and Ruthie feel this really strong family bond. And it's just, it's really interesting.
Yeah.
When they're looking through the photos and they're like, oh, these are disappointing because most of these people are strangers. And they've like mythologized their grandpa and they're fighting over their mom's hair color. And it's, and yet
there's the whole scene with the dried flowers in the book that
yeah,
the grandpa put there
yeah.
and the way that Lucille just crumples
oh
them up.
Oh my gosh,
and,
yes. Yeah. And it's so sad. When Lucille sees Ruthie in the schoolyard and like talks to her, she's like, how are you? I'm worried about you. Like she's literally talking to her like a 3-hour brunch friend. And I stole this from Frances Ha, one of my favorite movies. When Frances gets mad and says, stop treating me like a 3-hour brunch friend.
Oh my God.
And that is what
that
she treats her like. And it broke my heart.
Your brunch friend.
I use that all the time.
That's
like,
good.
That's a word in my vocabulary. Yeah.
Well, and there's the whole thing about the family portraits, the pictures and stuff getting flooded and then being ruined.
Yes.
So it's like this erasing of the past, or that's like the trying to hang on to the past, the way that Ruth especially is trying to hold on to these things so
tightly.
Hold
on to them, yes. And towards the middle of the movie, you see the state the state of their house and how it is so messy.
Well,
and,
yeah, Sylvie's basically a hoarder.
Yeah. And then the neighbors start getting involved. And then you can't help but think about the beginning of the movie when they're still with their mom. Their mom is alive. And do you remember their weird apartment? They're like tied to strings.
To go out on the balcony.
To go out on the balcony. Their house is messy. There's like milk bottles everywhere.
The neighbor's like, go back inside.
Even the neighbor, yes, says go back inside. And you can't help but think like, oh, Sylvie and their mother are very similar. Mm-hmm. And there's this beautiful line. I love it. It's one of my favorites. So it is Ruthie, and they're talking about when Sylvie first comes, they try to kind of figure her out and figure out how she's similar to their mother. And she says something like, they've eaten the same casseroles and listened to the same music. And I love that line.
Yeah, I love that. I love that.
But again, it's this really lovely portrait of like wanting to have family ties, the past coming back, mythologizing the past and your family members.
And loneliness.
Loneliness, but then also Lucille.
Right. So Marilyn Robinson, I saw an interview with her where she talks about loneliness as a privilege, something that you would seek out. And she suggests like giving yourself an interesting mind, like through books, like reading books so that you can enjoy solitude.
I do that. That's my life.
Yeah, I think most people who are into art,
yeah,
that's kind of like the goal. But yeah, so it's like solitude as a privilege. Again, Sylvie is so happy here.
Yeah.
Like you get the sense that in Fingerbone, she's happier than she's been in a long time. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And because it's this quiet house, mm-hmm. it's quiet town with this lake and... Mm-hmm. She can kind of do her own thing until she can't, until the town starts stepping in mm-hmm, a little bit. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But I love that idea. When I heard Marilyn Robinson say that,
loneliness
I was like,
as a privilege.
Yeah, as a privilege.
And Sylvie, so like Sylvie is so happy, right? And so happy to be with someone and have a companion. She goes so far as to try to change herself in the end. Mm-hmm. When she cleans up the house, that breaks my heart.
I know.
When they're burning all the newspapers and Ruthie says something like in the narration about, oh, she knew that there was like an invisible audience.
Yeah.
Watching
so she's
them.
Like acting it
she's
out.
She's talking to her, how did this book get in the house? I don't even know how this got here. She throws it in the fire and Ruthie's like, that was a library book.
It's so
that's
good.
One of the funniest parts of the movie.
It is. Because it's such a deadpan delivery to you. She's like, that's a library book.
Yeah. But it's so great because it goes back to this whole like nonconformist theme, right? It's like, yeah, you can be an outsider, but it's really lonely. So like Sylvie goes so far as to try to not be that weird. And that breaks my heart.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love her as this like symbol. Here's the thing. She's so much more effective than like Mary Poppins, Auntie Mame, obviously,
yeah,
because they're
fantasy.
Like cartoons.
Yeah. She's a wanderer.
She's a wanderer. She's like this great. And we already talked about how much, like why I love her so much as a nonconformist, because she is so like quiet.
Let's talk about her past it. A little bit too.
Yeah.
Because like all we get is that she's still married.
Yeah.
Hasn't seen her husband in years. Because he's even brought up once like, oh, what about Mr. Fisher? She's like, who?
Who?
It's like, your husband.
So, maybe he doesn't exist.
I think he exists. Because why would she make that up? Because it seems like she's
kind of unstable.
But she would rather not be married.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Maybe he did die. There's this line where Lucille says maybe... where Ruthie says Lucille thought that maybe he just died in the war and she has... It kind of drove her to be so weird.
Sure. Yeah. I'm open.
What were you saying?
I'm open to that. No. I was just saying that because we get her mom, one of the great aunts in the beginning, who says like, oh, Sylvie just dropped her new address and like, I'm going to write to her and hope the other aunt's like, oh, hope she's doing better now or something. Mm-hmm. So it is implied that she's had this break or something.
And she's been excommunicated by her mother. Why does she have two framed photos of her daughters stowed away in a drawer? Like what happened?
You know what too? I don't think it's necessarily what happened. I think some families... Having like family photos up and around the house is just like not a priority. And I know people
they're
like
framed,
this.
Framed though.
No, I know people like this though, where they keep those in a drawer just like that, where it's like they'd rather have art and stuff on the walls than like family photos. So I think it goes more to just say about what the family dynamic is. Like the family itself is very distant. I don't think they're just distant from Sylvie. I think
they were from Helen, the mom too.
Yeah, because when the mom drops the girls off, they're kind of like, oh, okay, like, you know. It's not like she gave them a heads up that she was coming by.
Because Helen and Sylvie were clearly so similar and such outsiders. My favorite thing she says, Sylvie, this is my favorite thing she says. It's when the neighbors come by and they're like, oh, you know, we're really worried about Ruthie. she seems so sad. And Sylvie says she looks sad. And Sylvie says she is sad. She should be sad.
Yeah.
That's the best thing she could say. Like, that is so good. So, so, so good. So simple, but really just sums up who she is, what she believes, and how she's different from these people.
Yeah,
her philosophy. Like, yeah, she should be sad.
Yeah, you got to feel it. Like, she has every reason. Both of the girls have every reason to be depressed.
Yeah, but there's no big... What I love about that is that never does Sylvie give this whole big speech acknowledging about how she's different and how she is not like the other people in the town.
Yeah.
It's just through her actions. It's just through, like, little words like that, like very small sentences.
Yeah.
Because I feel like there's always something, like, when in a movie like this where they're like, oh, we're different, we're not like the other people in town. There's never that by her.
Well, let's talk about some of the creepiness a little bit. So I know this movie's kind of haunted by the ghosts of the relatives of the family.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, from the flowers to the photos. Mm-hmm. But what I love, too, is that let's talk about the whole sequence where Sylvie takes Ruth. They wake up early that morning and they go on the lake to see this old cabin.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that really quick because...
Of course.
It's there's something very unsettling about it. And I think too, Sylvie, who you're kind of behind at that point. I think I'm totally behind Sylvie except for the hoarding and then except for the her talking about the children. So like when they're on the lake, here I'm going to play the clip because it's just such a great clip. But here is Sylvie. So Sylvie and Ruthie are on the boat. It's like 6 a.m. or 5 a.m. or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And they're rowing to go to this secret spot. And she's excused her for school for the day and stuff like that. And Sylvie says this about the surrounding area around the lake.
Wouldn't believe how many people live out here in the mountains, Ruthie. Sometimes you'll see a little smoke in the woods. There might be a cabin there with 10 children in it.
Have you ever seen any?
Sometimes if I think I see smoke, I go walking towards it. And now and then, I'm pretty sure there's children around me. I can practically hear them. It's one of the reasons I always keep crackers in my pockets.
And you can hear them.
You're probably gonna think I'm a little crazy, but I tried to catch one once. No, not trap it, but, you know, lure it out with marshmallows so I could see it. I mean, what would I do with another child?
So you have seen them.
Well, I stuck these marshmallows on these twigs from one of the apple trees. And then I just sort of sat to the side and waited, but it never came out. I was a little bit relieved, actually. I mean, a child like that might claw or bite, you know? But I did want to look at it. Now you're in on my secret. Maybe you'll have better luck.
So, yeah, there's...
So wait, what's the problem?
No, what do you think about that?
What do I think about? Okay.
Like here, there's two approaches, right?
Yeah.
There's either that she's kind of creating this magic world for Ruthie of kind of making nature and finger bones seem more magical than it is.
Yeah.
Or she genuinely believes this. And I get the sense that she genuinely believes
it. I get the sense she genuinely believes it too.
So she's kind of crazy. In that sense, she has... I mean, look, like
she does. She does.
You can hear. Well, here's the thing. Who am I to pass judgment? Also, because like I believe in certain things that maybe other people would be like, what, like supernatural stuff or whatever. But it's like, I think in the case of this film, there's something really eerie about her saying that because you're worried about her.
Here's the thing.
Yeah,
you're worried about her. Yes,
yeah.
That's the moment where you're. That's why later when they're in the boat, you're so on edge and you're so tense because you're like, okay, this woman is kind of schizophrenic.
Mm-hmm.
I get it.
Right.
I totally get it. And that is why. But then that's when I was saying it, like it dissipates so naturally.
It does. No, it absolutely
does. It's so strange and it adds to the eeriness because I feel like you're just waiting for something to happen. Like the sheriff, when he comes. There's no big confrontation, although there almost kind of is. Like, he's really an asshole. I hate everyone in this town.
Yeah.
I leave them alone. Like, you're not allowed to play hide and seek. That's against the law. Why don't you come to my house? Why the fuck would she come to your house? Who are you?
Yeah, I know.
No, I hate everyone in this town.
Yeah, I even hate Lucille.
Yeah, I kind of hate Lucille, too. I'm going to talk about this, actually. I'm going to ask you about Lucille. But Definitely. That's the moment where you realize that there could be
something wrong.
Danger in a boat, in the cold.
Oh, and just in terms of seeing what's in her mind, too.
Yes.
This is the first time in the movie we're like, whoa, hold on a second.
So here's my thing, and this is why I stand by the fact that I think the best thing for Ruthie is to be with her. Because, maybe because, like, both of these situations just were resolved so seamlessly. Like, yeah, if something bad happened, then obviously we'd be like, okay, no. But thinking broadly, I think that Ruthie is old enough where she's not so impressionable. She's not going to, like, jump off a bridge because Sylvie tells her to.
Uh-huh.
So I think for that reason, I'm okay with her staying in Sylvie's care. Does that make sense?
I think she'll be better off in Sylvie's care than anyone else's.
Yeah. And I think actually she will start caring for Sylvie, like taking care of Sylvie.
Yeah.
Because she's got to be like 14. Like, that's old enough.
Yeah, something like that. She might be even closer. Yeah, maybe 14.
If
that
they were
right.
Seven, like they looked like they were six or seven. Can I just say, Ruthie is my grandma Ruth, and I'm obsessed with this fact. She reminds me so much of my grandma. My grandma grew up my grandma graduated high school in 1955, which is crazy to me. She grew up in Boston. She had a sister who was very close in age to her. Like, she's only a year older than her. Her older sister's only a year older than her. They always went to school together. My grandma's really tall. Her name is Ruthie. Like, she's my grandma. When I saw her, I was like, this is so sweet. She has dark hair just like her. And I've seen pictures of her when she was little. Her hair looked like that. So I'm obsessed with Ruthie. And I think that she will be okay because of her age, maybe.
Yeah, I think so, too. I think she'll... I'm not worried about Ruthie.
No, no.
I'm worried about Lucille, honestly.
I'm worried about Lucille, but honestly, let's talk about Lucille. I'm obsessed with the fact that Lucille leaves and doesn't come back.
Well, can we talk to... I think the key scene with Lucille as an insight into... and also the relationship between the two girls... is when they go, they're getting their hair done and they need to go get the product.
God.
And she drags Ruthie to like that soda fountain with their friends. And you can tell Ruth is so embarrassed.
Yes.
And that's the perfect summation of like the difference between the two of them and what it is between them. Yeah.
And I also love there's a great line where Ruthie walks into the room and Lucille's like, I'll do your hair, like pick a dress. And Ruthie immediately picks something up and Lucille's like, not that. Like, my sister has literally done that to me. It's such a natural sister thing. But what I love about it is it's not like, as much as I love Terms of Endearment or Fried Green Tomatoes, like these movies that these are kind of inspired by. First of all, Terms of Endearment came before this, but like Fried Green Tomatoes, Steel Magnolias.
But this book was 1980.
Right. But those movies all came after this movie.
Oh, okay.
So you can't even say like this movie's like that. No, those movies are like this.
Terms of Endearment was before this.
Terms was before, right. But like Fried Green Tomatoes, which is also set in like the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, those are very sweet and endearing. But with this, like the whole Lucille thing is not sugar-coated at all.
Yeah.
It's not sentimental at all. Can I play the clip of when it's the narration that's read by Ruth about Lucille leaving, and it breaks my heart.
They talked through the night about Lucille's troubles at home, and Miss Royce gave her the spare room. In effect, she adopted her, and I had no sister after that night.
That's it. In effect, she adopted her, and I had no sister after that night. She tells us that Lucille's not coming back.
You know what,
and it's
too?
It's so cut and dry and it's so sad.
I think that kind of thing used to happen more often. And I don't think this is just like a back in the day thing, but like you hear people that are growing up mid 20th century or earlier of like, oh yeah, this sibling like got a job at 15 and like left home and stuff.
Yeah.
And it's like, I think that kind of thing was more prevalent of just like, especially because their home is so, I don't want to say they come from a broken home because Sylvie is there and she's housekeeping, literally. But
they've been through a lot.
They've been through a lot and they've been kind of passed around from their mom to like their great aunts to Sylvie.
Grandma.
And Sylvie's not really present. So yeah, it's exactly the grandma.
Mm.
So yeah, there's a sense that this is something that just happened.
But the scene when she comes home from the dance.
Oh, I know.
And Ruthie's like, how was the dance, Lucille? And Lucille's like, it was fine. And Ruthie's like, tell me about it. She goes, well, tell me about it. And then Lucille's like, I'm tired. That makes me so sad. Like, sister fights They make me so, so upset.
Well, you can relate, huh?
I know. And Ruthie, I'm obsessed with her. But let's talk about, do you feel bad for Lucille at all? Ever?
Sure. Because look at the situation.
It's very hard to be an adolescent girl, like growing up in this weird household in such a constraining time and town. So I do kind of sympathize with
her. It's not even just that. It's the mother's suicide and being passed around to different relatives. Like, mm-hmm. I can only imagine the toll that would take on a child. So I do, sure, I feel sympathy towards her. But it's funny the way that she processes it as opposed to Ruth.
Yes.
And yeah, I mean, I feel a little bad for it. Like, obviously, I think that her upbringing shaped, you know, her direction.
And yet she abandons her sister so easily.
She does. It's not even just her sister. It's family. It's Sylvie, too.
Well, she never really cared about Sylvie.
It's funny because when Robinson wrote the book, I watched an interview and she talks about reading a lot of the books on like the bestsellers list from the paper. And she would read the books and she's like, these all have shallow characters. And she thought that she was intent on writing something that had real nuanced, complex characters. And I think two characters that a lot of this is based, I think a lot of it is kind of like autobiographical because she grew up in the Pacific Northwest in the 50s. So I'm not sure like if she had a sister or like what their relationship was. I don't think like her mother committed suicide and their aunt came in. I'm not sure if that part's real, but the setting and the feel and probably a lot of the family dynamics are based on her own life, as far as I know.
Yeah.
Did you know that the living room set is built? It was built like either in a timber warehouse, according to Forsyth, or built in a high school gym, according to Marilyn Robinson.
Well, one we of can those two ask things. Christine.
That's true. We can. We can set the record straight because, yeah, each person said a different thing. But that house, it's kind of crazy because that house was built like the facade and then the interior was built in like a. Either, well, like I said, like a timber warehouse or a high school. But
see, how did they fill it with water?
Yeah, because it was in a thing. And so they could easily flood it. And they flooded it at the end. Like they filmed all the other stuff.
Did
like
they?
Okay, they're like, okay, are we sure we have everything we need? Like, okay, yes, if you're sure, then we can flood it. But also special effects in this movie. So Bill Forsyth was talking a lot about this in the interview I saw with him. On that, you mentioned the powerhouse indicator disc, which I highly recommend. I think as of now, it's the only way to get the film on Blu-ray. I don't even know. Does it have a DVD release? I don't know if it has DVD. But the Blu-ray, it's from a British label called Powerhouse Indicator. They're beautiful. They're basically the British Criterion in a way. And I think you have to import it from the UK. But the disc is region-free, so it'll play on any Blu-ray player in the world. It's not locked, so you don't have to worry about that. But highly recommend the disc. The disc has a bunch of interviews on it. It's just really insightful. Beautiful disc. So I was going to say, yeah, so we should definitely ask Christine about where that was filmed. But there were a lot of cool special effects, like the flooding of the town and stuff. That was all done with some weird kind of like analog effects.
No way.
That Bill Forsyth in the interview was basically like, yeah, I couldn't tell you how they did it, but like they did it. This is pre-CGI.
Yeah.
So a lot of that stuff is like super convincing.
The
also,
dog.
The bridge that they had was only like so long.
I'm sure.
So they like extended it via special effects and stuff. Which is just so cool. Bill Forsyth also talks about, here's a quote from him that I want to read. This is what drew him to the book. His story is that a friend of his, an actress friend, gave him the book to read. And he became obsessed with it. And was like, I need to make this into a film. And apparently, he went off and made it. And he didn't even think like, oh, she wanted to be in it. Like, as Sylvie. And this actress didn't find out about it until the movie was like done. And I guess she was mad at him.
Oh, no.
But his quote, this is what Bill Forsyth had to say about the book. He said, so many images began to attract me. I became covetous of these scenes. I began to feel the need to own them in a movie. But there was also something else. When I was reading this book, I began to feel the way people should when they watch movies. The novel seemed to be touching on all the senses. You're exposed to emotional information, poetical insights, thoughts. Things are coming at you on different levels. When I read it, I felt this is how movies should be.
Wow.
It's a story that happened, in a sense, in an instant in Ruthie's head. And I think the movie perfectly captures, especially that last thing he said. But also, who can't relate to, you know, as filmmakers, his line about, I began to feel the need to own them in a movie.
Yeah.
I feel like not even when
That's
you're just
a
reading
great
a book,
statement. Yeah.
But when you hear a piece of music or you hear about
hear
a situation,
a story,
you hear a story and you're like, I need to own that in a movie.
Yeah, I love that.
Beautiful.
One of my favorite thoughts. This is kind of going back to like what we were talking about, like the creepiness, the eeriness. One of my favorite things that Ruthie says, like one of her thoughts was like, they're on that island and they're looking at that really dilapidated house, and she thinks about the children. She's like, I can see why Sylvie felt that there were children here. I felt so too, but I didn't think so.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What a great, it's like, so that's good. Poetry.
It is. Yeah. The book is poetry. The book is basically poetry.
Amazing.
It's incredible. Like when I first started reading the book, I had to adapt. I was reading it very slowly because it's so beautifully mm-hmm. written that it just took time to like process what I was reading, like conjuring the full extent of her images. Yeah, you can borrow it. It's beautiful.
Wait, I just remembered something really like kind of scary. Also, now that I'm thinking about like the eeriness, when they're on the boat, and of course this whole like she has told her that she sees children. I think it's when they're on the boat. I think this is the scene when she's like, can you just think about how many people are down there right
yes,
now?
Yes, from the train accident.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, that's eerie. But she says it in such a joyful way, kind of. Or not joyful, but she's just fascinated by that.
Like, yeah.
There's a whole train full of bodies down there. And that's like interesting so to scary. Her. It's not sad. Well, maybe it's a little sad.
What's
but
the
it's...
story with their grandpa? Was he the conductor or something? What were they saying? Or he was just
I
like...
I think he was just a passenger on the train.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
And then she has another like kind of, I mean, she has a lot of weird lines, but another one I love is, it's something she's talking about sleeping when you're really tired.
Yes, when
she's
they
like,
come
it's
back
not like
that, yeah.
sleep, it's like being dead.
Dead, yeah. I know what she means though, and it's spot on.
Yeah.
What do you think, kind of lastly, before we go into Sight and Sound, what do you think about the ending of the film? Do you think it's a hopeful ending or do you think it's sad? I think you think it's hopeful.
Well, I don't really, like, I think the whole burning of the house is, like, really interesting. It's, like, they're freeing themselves of that mythology of their, like, grandpa who died in a train and, like, their mom's accident, their mom's suicide. And just, again, this, like, this thing about town, it's like, oh, that's the house of weirdos. And they just burn it. And I love that.
Mm-hmm.
But when they're running on the train, yeah, you know, I think it's hopeful. Because of all the things that I said previously, it's like, I don't think Ruthie is in danger. I think that she is smart enough and old enough to recognize. She loves her. She loves Sylvie. Sylvie loves her. The film doesn't really let you be hopeless, I feel like.
No, no.
Because of, again, how in all of these situations that could have gone bad, they didn't.
True.
Well, I don't know. Do you think it's not hopeful?
No, I think it's quietly hopeful. I think I keep saying it's quietly beautiful, it's quietly eerie. This movie, it's just a quiet movie. But no, I think it is like I think it's ultimately slightly hopeful, but no, I do think it's hopeful. I think it's funny because in the book, the book ends with it continues after that. And the book goes into Sylvie and Ruth going around and living different places and coming back to places. And it kind of ends with that. So the movie, interesting choice to end on that trestle, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
Like totally, it's a great final image, but it definitely leaves it a little more open-ended, which I think movies are so good at doing.
Yes.
Like books can kind of do an epilogue and be like, this is what happened, but movies are...
It leaves you to think about like the possible danger or the possible hope.
Yeah.
I think it's pretty helpful.
Yeah, I think so too.
Should we do Sight and Sound?
Let's do it. Let's do Sight and Sound. What is your favorite sight
Mine
from the film?
Mine is combined. So,
I'll go first then. I'll do sight.
Go for it.
My favorite sight is, it's just Ruth standing in front of that frosted home in the woods.
Yeah.
With the ice on the leaves and, you know, Sylvie cues it up beforehand, how it crunches beneath your feet. Like, it's beautiful. It's eerie. I think it sums up the movie because it is beautiful. Her standing there and it's kind of glistening. But it's also creepy.
Yeah, definitely creepy.
Who lived here? And it's like in this canyon that doesn't really get much sunlight.
They keep
stuff.
Mentioning that.
Yeah. So I love that image.
That's a great image.
How about you?
Well, mine's combined. Well, I have like one combined one and then I have a separate independent sight. So my independent sight is when the sheriff is telling Sylvie that, oh, there's going to be a trial. And then it cuts to a shot of Sylvie's shoes. She's standing on like the edge of her weird like attic bedroom.
Yeah.
All you see are her shoes. I love that.
That shot is a couple times throughout the movie and it's used really well.
I love it.
Also, when the church women come over, they use that shot too.
Yes. But my combined one is when the house is flooded and the girls come downstairs to find Sylvie, and she splashes through, and she just says, hi. But it's combined sight and sound, because you get the sound of the splashes, which are hilarious, and you're like, what's going on? Like, what is moving towards me? The way she delivers the line, hi, and just the image of them on the stairs with a flooded house.
She pops in frame and pops out.
And her popping into frame.
Yeah. Let's hear it.
Hi.
It's so good.
Great timing.
There's like great timing, perfect timing. The splashing. Oh my God, it's so good.
Yeah.
What's yours?
Mine is, so Sylvie is talking to Ruth. Lucille's already left at this point. She's living with the home ec teacher. And it's right before she's queuing up that house in the valley. And she's telling her about it and if she wants to go or not. So this is what they say.
I'd like to go.
You would?
Yeah.
Tomorrow?
I have to study tomorrow.
How about Monday? I could write you a note.
Monday I have a test, that's why I have to study.
Oh, okay. Another day then?
Yes.
Okay. Are you going to study tonight?
I have a book report to write.
You know I should read. I don't know why I stopped. I always enjoyed it. Do you think I could sit with you?
All right.
Okay.
That is one of my favorite scenes.
I love.
I even wrote down the way that she says, like, do you think I can sit with you?
Yeah. Oh, it's heartbreaking, but it's also like really lovely.
It's so lovely. And she's like, okay, like a little, like,
I think it's the perfect example of Sylvie's mental state.
Childlike. She is the child asking if she can hang out. And she's like, yay,
exactly.
Like I can hang out with you.
Yeah, exactly.
And I love the way that Ruth is like, well, Monday's the test. That's why I have to study.
But she ends up taking that Monday off.
I know. It's really cute when she says, I don't care. Like, write me a note.
Yeah.
Aww.
I love it. Pauline. All right, this is the segment where we read Pauline Kael's review of the film. In this case, unfortunately, our girl Pauline was not a huge fan. She says, Marilyn Robinson's novel about two orphan sisters and the nature-loving itinerant aunt who arrives to keep house for them has a wonderful representation of a psychological state. Aunt Sylvie seems to spend her life falling into a non-verbal world staring at nothingness. But the novel also has a bag lady mystique, a poetic view of vagrancy. The idea seems to be that if you give up conventional values and material things, you can wander the earth and lead a magical life. Bill Forsyth, who adapted and directed this movie version, was perhaps too respectful of the internalized and estranged nature of Robinson's vision. It's all subtext. He doesn't make the material his own. He doesn't find his own rhythms. The early scenes are whimsical and promising, but the later ones have a clammy, awkward lyricism. Yeah, I could not disagree with Pauline more here.
Why do we love her so?
Because when she gets it right, she gets it really right, I guess.
Know.
But yeah, here, this is like, Pauline, come on. Like, okay.
Have a heart.
I can get, like, it sounds like Pauline actually read the book because she mentions it several times. But I think I can get thinking this movie's a little too literary. Like, I could get why that would turn you off. But
yeah.
I love movies that feel like books.
Me too. And I think maybe she's thinking, maybe she has a problem with Bill Forsyth's, like, passiveness and very kind of, like you said, like, he's very quiet, soft-spoken. He let Christine take control. Like, maybe she has a problem with him not being so, like, such a, like, visible director, such a, like, flashy guy.
Oh, I don't. Yeah, of course, one of her big, you know, she's a huge champion of Brian De Palma, who, don't get me wrong, I love, but all about whipping the camera around and showing you salacious stuff, and you get none of that here. But no, I was kind of surprised that she really kind of went in on this one. So
sad.
Yeah. It's down to the philosophy of the story.
Yeah.
Anyway, should we do Letterboxd? I have a 4-star review here. It says, maybe the best depiction of loneliness without sinking you in it. Christine Lottie is so warm with her pockets full of little treasures she's collected and her ability to make everything feel okay. All these women carry around a loneliness, but what's interesting is to see how they try to reject it. When they see their pain reflected in someone else, do they turn away from it or linger around them, protected by what they both know?
Wow.
It ends on a question.
That's really well written. Someone gave it 1 star and wrote, how beautifully boring, more depressing than Shindy's List.
Oh, I saw that one.
Shindy.
I didn't know we were so familiar with that, that we were abbreviating Schindler's List. I have a 4-star here that says, quite simply, one of the prettiest and most thoughtful films about mental illness I've seen. Mm. Housekeeping lacks judgment, but doesn't shy away from awareness of disarray. Christine Lottie is fantastic, as is the choice to show her aunt's mania through the splintering of sisters who accept or try to run away from that energy and how their lives will be very different because of it.
Aww. Someone just hearted it. There's no stars, but it's written, rarely have I seen chaos portrayed with such delicacy and beauty.
Mm, yes.
Shimmering gold and silver cans stacked like building blocks, newspapers with seemingly endless purposes, nameless cats spontaneously materializing and overflowing trench coat pockets. I love that. When she shows up and the great aunts take off her coat and she has like a newspaper scarf.
Yeah, yeah.
I was so confused. I'm like, is that to keep out the rain? Like, what is that? It was great.
Here's the 2-star. A movie that's almost nice and magical, but just sad and depressing, huh?
I don't get it. Yes, sad things, tragic things happen in the movie, but I would not say this is a depressing movie by any means.
No.
Shindy's List? Are you kidding me?
Yeah, give me a break.
Are you kidding? Oh, okay. You'll appreciate this one. 4.5 stars. If Twin Peaks was a slice of life anime.
Totally. Yeah, totally. last one for me. 4.5 stars. I love this one. The movie equivalent of walking outside in the winter at around 5:30 in the evening when the sky and the snow are all the same electric blue color. And the only thing you can see are the little golden windows of other houses and the people moving inside of them. Damn.
So sweet.
That might be the most beautiful review we've read so far from Letterboxd.
That is so sweet.
Well, that concludes the first half of our episode. Now we move into the very exciting second half of the episode where we sit down with Christine Lottie.
I'm so excited.
Our guest today is a brilliant actress, director, author, and activist. Throughout her prolific career, she's won 2 Golden Globes, an Emmy, and an Oscar for Best Short Film for directing. She also received an Oscar nomination for Best Supporting Actress for the film Swing Shift. In addition to Bill Forsyth, she's worked with directors such as Jonathan Demme, Sidney Lumet, Edward Zwick, and Norman Jewison. More recently, you can find her in the CBS Paramount Plus show Evil, as well as Chicago Hope, Curb Your Enthusiasm, Law & Order SVU, The Blacklist, and the film A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. We're so excited to welcome to the podcast, Christine Lottie.
What did you do today, Sylvie?
Oh, I walked around.
Collecting newspapers.
Oh, I met a really nice lady at the station. She was traveling all the way through from South Dakota to Portland to see her cousin hanged.
Why'd you get involved with such trashy people? It's embarrassing.
I didn't get involved. She couldn't even come for supper.
You asked her?
She was afraid she'd miss her connection. They're always real prompt about hanging people. See, she's his only relative. Except for his father, and he was the one who got strangled. I thought it was very kind of her to make the trip. I wouldn't say trashy, Lucille. She didn't strangle anybody.
Yay! Hi, Christine.
Hi, so nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks for doing this. We're so excited to talk to you about this movie. We both love it. It was my first time, as I just mentioned, it was my first time seeing it. And I was really shocked at how I hadn't seen it before. Like, this is very much my type of movie. This like mid-80s to 90s book adaptations centered around women. So I was just shocked that I hadn't seen this. And it was such a delight. And I just want to thank you for that. And my first question is really just like, how did they approach you about this role? How did they describe her? Like, did they describe her as eccentric, quirky, crazy even? I don't know. Like, how did they win you over to the role?
Well, first of all, I will say that Diane Keaton was supposed to play this part.
Yeah, we read about that.
Yeah, she dropped out to do something, Baby Boom or something, mm-hmm. some other movie. So when it came my way, I was just, I was floored because it was the kind of part that I'd been looking for my whole life. And it came around at a time in my life that I was just so hungry and ready, you know, ready for the feat. It was she was never described to me by Bill Forsythe as crazy, ever. The word crazy never came up. That came up after it came, the movie came out. There was a Q&A. I remember a woman saying in the audience, you know, I think Sylvie should have been locked up. She was clearly crazy. Bad influence on her niece. And I looked at her like she was crazy. I thought that never occurred to me that she would be detrimental to her niece. It was only that she would be a positive influence and a way for her niece to be truly free.
Yeah.
Like, so that was it. The word never came up. She was described as eccentric. And I read Marilyn Robinson's novel, of course, which is so brilliant. And it was very close to the screenplay. Bill Forsythe did a really great adaptation, true adaptation. But it was kind of a skeleton. So I had to do a lot of backstory. I had to make it up. A lot of hints, a lot of clues given by Marilyn and by Bill. But I made up a lot of her stuff and what made her the way she was. So honestly, it was kind of, it was like a outline. And I just had to, it was like the bones and I had to fill in the blood and the guts.
Yeah. Such as, like, can you give us an example of something you might have made up about her? Or?
Well, I think that she was really, really lonely and had come to accept it as just part of life.
Yeah.
But there was something in her that craved connection, but didn't know how to do it. She scared a lot of people away, especially men.
Yeah.
Women were scared of her too, were judging her.
Right.
I think she tried to have children. I don't think that was in the cards for her. Mm-hmm. I think her husband, again, I'm making all this up. The husband was controlling and tried to keep her down and, you know, in place. And mm-hmm. she couldn't do that. Her spirit was already too free. And she couldn't, having tasted some freedom already, she couldn't conform. And I think that was painful to leave that. It might have been abusive emotionally. I don't think it was physical in my backstory. But anyway, she secretly craves intimacy and connection and love, but has kind of written it off. Like, it's not going to happen in my life and I'm fine and I'll just be a wandering person. And I don't, maybe even convincing herself that I don't really need it.
Right.
So when she meets this kindred spirit, this child, it is revelatory and scary. And, you know, dare she, is she going, you know, is it, she's just scared of it all and tentative. And I think that underneath though is this huge need for love and to give love and to receive it. So it's something that it's been void in her whole life. She's not had it. So I just increased the stakes by mm-hmm. giving her this backstory so that nothing was ever casual for Sylvie, even though she has the affect of, I'm cool, everything's cool. I think there's surging deep need in her. And that was very important for me to find. I don't even think Bill Forsythe really understood all that, even though he wrote it. So he and I would talk a lot about that and wanting to make sure that every scene was very specific in terms of that subtext.
Yeah. Well, that's why it's so moving when she finally does decide to, like, okay, now I'm going to try to conform and clean up the house and dress differently and fix my hair. That's why it's so moving when she does that, because it's so not her, but that's the length she would go to have companionship. And it's beautiful. Greg, actually, you had a question about Bill and directing.
So there's a 2017 interview with Bill Forsythe where he credits you as being a co-director on the film in terms of saying, like, you were such a help for the young actresses, that the two sisters, and like, do you have any insight into, because I know Bill was kind of more of a sort of a casual, more casual director, just in terms of, like, he kind of let the actors do their thing and stuff. And So do you have any memories working with Bill and like working with the girls?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I wouldn't describe Bill as a casual director. I think he's a genius. And I think his attention to detail, his understanding of humanity and in all its quirky, hilarious, tragic, you know, all the ways in which people are just, you know, just beautifully human, tragically human, hilariously human. He understands all that. As far as working with the little girls, yeah, I did take that on. I love to improvise, and I improvised a lot with them to establish relationships. We even improvised the scenes in our own words to maybe find different lines or different behavior. I think he is a little more, in terms of actors, a little more hands off. So I kind of did take over that role as, I don't know if it was acting coach or collaborator with them. So, but Bill was their,
go ahead. It was their first role, right? For both of the girls, their first time?
I believe it was their first time in a film. I think they've done school plays. So, and they were incredible, just amazingly fresh and open and brave. But I remember one day, Bill to me was Sylvie in a way. I remember copying him, certain aspects of him, and stealing them for the character. I copied so many things for this character. It was one of those great pre-production periods of research. So Bill was wearing his cardigan sweater, which I think he had won and he wore it every day. And it was most often than not, you know, the buttons were off. They were just not buttoned correctly because he could give a shit. He's just, and you know, it's cold. He puts his sweater on, he buttons, and he doesn't look to see that it's not buttoned correctly. So I stole that for Sylvie. Just a little research I did. Also, I went to the zoo and I thought there's something very animalistic about this character. She's so primal and, you know, not kind of conventionally human. So I watched how monkeys, a certain kind of monkey, I forget what kind it was, how they would eat. And because they're always worried about having their food stolen, they had their food very close to their mouths so that there wasn't a lot of travel distance that where this food could be stolen. So, you know, if you're eating like this, the chances are no one's going to grab it out of your hands or up in the air. So that's how Sylvie ate. Was if you yeah. notice everything she's, mm-hmm. you know, and looking around like, okay, is someone going to take this? And that was one thing. And then another thing I stole was from Annie Dillard. I had just read a book called Pilgrim on Tinker Creek. I don't know if you know this author, but she's extraordinary.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah, look, check it out. It's if you like housekeeping, you'll love this book. She is a just an incredible writer, and she wrote about her relationship with a creek and all its minutiae and all the specificity of watching the bugs and the frogs and the water and how present Annie Dillard was in with nature. And that's how I think Sylvie is. She's so one of her amazing gifts, which makes her the opposite of crazy, is how present she is.
Yeah.
And in the moment. And one of the things that Annie Dillard described herself as doing is she would take these long strides so that she could feel the curvature of the earth. And I thought, yeah, Sylvie takes long strides because she walks so much that she wants to feel the curvature of the earth. So that was another thing I stole.
I love that.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
What about the ketchup? Is the ketchup in the book? Her obsession with ketchup?
I don't recall if it's in the book or not, but regardless, it's such a great film because first of all, it's the only condiment that would be readily accessible, right? At any truck stop or train stop, there would be those ketchup packets, or maybe not back then, but there would be ketchup because what else do you put on anything back then?
Right. Go ahead.
I was going to say, so I know Bill Forsyth said that Marilyn Robinson, well, they would read, the whole crew would had little pocket versions of the novel that they would take out and read before the scene. They'd read the passage from the book. And I know Marilyn Robinson visited the set a couple of times. Do you have any memories of meeting her, what her impression of was of what you guys were doing?
I remember being in awe of her. I think she seemed happy with what we were doing. Honestly, I don't think I like socialized with her much because I was so into the character and I was, you know, working every single day. And right. I don't recall talking with her that much, but when I did, I'm sure I asked her a million questions and I'm sure she was like, oh my God. But I just wanted any information I could get out of her. Because clearly she knew this character and she knew the blood and the guts, even though she didn't write a lot of the blood and guts of this character. I know that she understood it and it was all in the subtext. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like the Sylvia's family, nobody talked about anything. Mm-hmm. And that's why there was so much mystery to Sylvia, which is why I loved the opportunity to play her because I could, you know, fill in a lot of those gaps.
So much mystery, like the tin cans. She never explains the tin cans and what she's doing with them.
Yeah, I think for me, it was, you know, the world is an opportunity always for art. Mm-hmm. And creativity. And when you've got tin cans, why, first of all, why would you ever throw them away? Because they're so useful for, you know, storing other things or for making castles. And especially if they're shiny and clean. Mm-hmm. You know, she just, you can call her a hoarder, but I also think that she's an artist in terms of her life and her home. Keeping the water and not giving a shit about the water was to me artistic. Choice. It was like, this is really fucking fun. And why would you want to get rid of this water? This is so wild and fun.
It is. It's amazing. What did you do? Like what every morning to become Sylvie? Did you have a routine? Did you have something that you did every day to get into character?
I remember during that time jogging, those were the days when I could still jog. My knees were really good. And I remember jogging outside a lot and listening at that time. I think Paul Simon's Graceland had just come out. I just listened to music and just get the feeling of running. And it's what I did last night on the beach here, actually. I put on Beyonce's Renaissance, have you heard? I'm sure. And I'm walking my dog along. I live right at the beach and walking him, like wading in the water and skipping in the water and skipping and skipping. And people were looking at me like I was Sylvie. And I thought, free the skip. You know, why is it okay if people jog or run or walk, but somehow skipping is not considered, you know, cool?
So
or,
true. I know.
It's like, free the that. Skip. Free the skip.
I was skipping
and having a great time. Yeah. That's what I did. I think that sense of freedom that I felt last night is what I try to do every morning before I play Sylvie, because that's her gift, mm-hmm. is that she's been able to live in a very oppressive time for women, been able to live a life of freedom. And she had to pay the price, loneliness, you know, judgment, probably been afraid a lot, been, you know, stared at a lot and maybe even attacked or, you know, some kind of physical abuse probably. Back then, you know, a woman alone without children. That's why the girls were so like, you don't want children. You don't have children. You don't have a husband. You're not with your, how can a woman be without a man? I mean, how is that? They didn't even understand that concept.
Yeah. Yeah. And one strength of the movie I love so much is that Sylvie doesn't try to convince them. She just presents her outlook on life. She doesn't give them a lecture after that and says like, oh, you know, like not everyone has to get married. She just simply says like, can't be good at everything. Like, that's it. And that's one of the things I love about her and I love about the movie.
Yeah, I agree. It is a, I think it's a feminist masterpiece. Yeah. Honestly, today I thought, oh my God, this is everything in terms of what, you know, women ultimately want and have craved probably for centuries.
Right.
But what's so great about it is that it never gets into any kind of lecturing or, you know, finger pointing. It's just, I'm living my life and the best way I know how and the most free way I can. If this inspires you, come on board.
Yes.
It was cool that Lucille chose the opposite, that Lucille chose to be the girly girl and conform. But, you know, again, that was without judgment for Sylvie. It was like, okay, I just hope she's happy. I miss her, but there's no judgment.
Oh, yeah.
I love that. What was filming? Because you guys were in Canada for a
few months there from like the fall through the winter. So what was that like filming on location? And I know they too, they built the house. Was the interior of the house? Because I know Marilyn Robinson said it was in a school gym, but then Bill Forsyth in an interview said it was like in a timber space, like a timber warehouse or something. Do you remember?
Gosh, no, I don't remember. It could have been either one of those or both. The exterior, of course, was, you know, out in the woods and incredible. But yeah, we must have had it built on a stage somewhere. Yeah, I honestly don't recall. But then, yes, shooting in Canada was unbelievable. We shot in Nelson, British Columbia, and it was so beautiful and remote. And, you know, just those the idea of all those mountains that the grandfather painted as a symbol, I think, to me of just promise and adventure and you know, just life beyond the rules and life beyond what is considered okay and conventional. We live that every day being on location. It was really extraordinary.
Amazing. Was it actually very cold or was it actually winter? Did you guys actually shoot in winter?
I don't recall. It must have been. I mean, there was snow on the ground, right? And
yeah,
I think it was like our breath. You could see our breath. So I don't remember being cold. I mean, I probably wore some long underwear under that coat because, you know, she never had a scarf or mittens or anything practical.
No, she had a newspaper scarf when she first arrived. So.
Yeah, she had the insulation.
Yeah, I love that. So this movie, I feel like this everyone that sees this movie is so moved by it. Like, it's such a profound movie for those who have seen it, but it just seems, Roger Ebert was a big champion of this film. And I know that he had an event at Ebert Fest 10, 15, 20 years ago where he honored the film. And I think some of the cast and crew came and talked about it. What was that experience like? And seeing sort of a revival.
It was extraordinary. Bill Forsyth came, I came, it was in Illinois. They screened it. The actual film version. It was incredible. At the time, it got kind of lost, fell sort of in the cracks during Columbia. I think
yeah.
was David Putnam had just taken over Columbia, and I think the next people regime that came in wanted to make sure that all the films that he greenlit failed in a way. They didn't want to support it. It was political. This film was, you know, such a beautiful gem. And I think it was kind of pushed aside because for political reasons.
Which is so sad. We've talked about this and we talked about it earlier when we were recording. And that's one of the reasons we're doing this movie actually is because Greg wants more people to see it. So we're super excited.
It's just in the movie. When I first saw the movie, it affected me so much. And I immediately went out and read the book. I hadn't read any Marilyn Robinson. And it just like, it was a world that I became obsessed with and I wanted to live in it. And I wanted to experience it over and over. And yeah, I think what you said too about Bill Forsyth capturing the film or the book so well is true. Like, and he had this kind of literal approach that just picked the book up and dropped it into a film. And it has this great, like, it is the book. It is literally a film version of the book. And I think
exactly.
Yeah.
And what's funny though is because this movie came out and then we had so much more of these like kind of literary movies that involved women. Like there was like Steel Magnolias, Fried Green Tomatoes, Mermaids, Mystic Beaches. Pizza. And it's like, I feel like this was the original and no one's seen it and it drives me crazy.
I know. The fact that you probably never heard of it, right?
I hadn't until Greg told me.
Yeah. No, I'm so appreciative of you getting it out there still. I think it's a lot of people will be very happy to discover it.
Oh, we're on a mission to make housekeeping a household name. That is, that's our mission.
Oh, fantastic. I love that.
Yeah.
And so you did right after this, your next film was Running on Empty. Was that the next one you did? Cause I know that was 88.
I think so. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
That was a good run that, but those, those two films back to back, we're like, okay, this is really exciting.
Amazing.
Yeah, they're both just so incredible. So I guess looking back on you're so prolific. Looking back on your career, where does housekeeping kind of stand for you?
I think it's the pinnacle, honestly. I think it's the top. I think it was, again, it was, that came at a time. I mean, I've done things that have been unbelievably exciting and challenging, but I think this role for me was the best one, the most complex, most different from me. I think it's maybe the work I'm most proud of. Wow. Have you seen it just today? I'm thinking of all my, I've been doing this for 40 years, over 40 years. I think it's my favorite thing I've ever done.
I love to hear that. That's amazing. Yeah. What about, how did you get into writing? Because we know you have a book.
I do. And I just wrote a play based on my book. Oh my goodness. I am workshopping at the Berkshire Theater Festival in a couple of weeks.
How exciting.
Very cool.
Yeah. So I wrote a book. It's a book of personal essays, and it's called True Stories from an Unreliable Eyewitness and a Feminist Coming of Age. And it's just based on my life and mostly my family and a little of my career, but then I wrote the play and during the pandemic. So, you know, we'll see what happens. It's a one woman show.
Yeah. Incredible.
So cool. I love that.
Me too.
Yeah.
We're really curious as to, like, what are some other directors, films, like, our podcast is all about just like film love. Like, we are just film nerds, geeks, cinephiles, and movies are our life. So we were just curious, like, can you tell us a little bit about like the kinds of movies you like, or maybe some of your favorite movies or directors?
So yeah, I love, of course, female-centric movies about women, written by women, directed by women. I did really love every movie that Bill Forsyth directed, every movie that Jonathan Demme directed. Mm-hmm. Jonathan Demme, he was such a extraordinary humanist. And I think he, like Bill Forsyth, just loved every single person on the set and, you know, would treat an extra with as much dignity as the big lead, you know, star. And that's not always the case. You know, mm-hmm. There's usually a sort of hierarchical patriarchy on sets, especially ones directed by men. Mm-hmm. And he was so not like that. His power was about lifting others up, which to me is like a feminist power, the way a woman would hopefully in her highest self would define power is about not keeping others down, but lifting others up. And Jonathan Demme was like that. God, I loved working with Sidney Lumet too. He was an old school guy. Yeah, he was great. I have a funny story about Sidney Lumet, which I think would be fun to talk about. So, and he wouldn't mind because when I gave him an award once, I think I gave him the LA Film Critics Award. I told this story and he loved it. So doing the dinner scene in Running on Empty between me and my father. And I don't know if you remember that scene, but it's.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So yeah, it's really emotional. And I haven't seen him in 15 years and I'm asking him to, you know, take my child and take care of him because my child wants to come above ground and become a pianist, a piano player at Juilliard. So it's a big ask and it's a big reunion. And anyway, it goes, Sydney has two cameras set up and we did it in one take and it went beautifully. Stephen Hill was a genius to work with. I didn't have to do anything. He just gave me so much. And I look over at Sydney and I look around at the crew and these big burly guys, you know, the boom guy and the sound guy and all that, they're all weeping. And I thought, oh, yes, yes. So Sydney comes running over and he said that, yeah, that was amazing. I said, he said, do you know how I know that it was really good? And I said, because all the crew guys are crying. He said, no, because I have a heart on. It was so good.
Oh my gosh. I love that. That is what an unexpected story.
He was into it. Yeah. He was so excited by the work that he got very.
That's so funny. Yeah, sometimes you'll hear about directors laughing during scenes, like, because it's just like a reaction. Sometimes during a very dramatic scene, and the director will be like stifling laughter. But that's the first time I've heard of someone getting a hard on during a dramatic scene.
Yeah, I mean, I love it when I look over and I can tell out of the corner of my eye I see directors crying or, you know, being moved in any way. But I didn't notice the reaction. But I thought that was really funny.
Aww. That's great. I love that. That's a great story.
great story. Did the girls ever go on to do anything after this movie? I don't actually know.
You know, I was thinking about that today. I don't know. I honestly wish I'd followed their careers. Maybe we could Google them and see if they've done. I hope so. They were both so extraordinary.
They were. And those are hard roles. They really were.
There were so many moments that I just... The way that Ruthie, when she got, you know, taller and she started developing breasts and she wanted to hide them because she suddenly was conscious of her body. And her sister says, you know, stop doing that. It just draws more attention to them. And Ruthie goes, to what?
Yeah.
And she says, never mind.
That's a really interesting moment, actually, because at first it did take me a second. I'm like, what is she talking about? Her hair or... But that is, what a great moment. There's great sister moments in this. They really are.
Oh my God. That first time when they decide to go separate ways at the drugstore, Ruthie goes home and then Lucille makes that decision to not follow her, but turn back. It's like, oh my God, that's it. That's the separation.
It's so heartbreaking. I mean, I die when she comes home from the dance and Ruthie asks her, like, well, tell me about it. And she's just like, I'm tired. I don't feel like talking. That kills me. That part really, really kills me.
And that was the night she left.
That's the night she left.
Disgusted by Sylvie lying in that bed with the book on her face, that she just went, I'm leaving. This is too much.
Yeah. And a part of me wants to feel bad. And I do sympathize with Lucille. I mean, she's been through a lot. It's very hard growing up as a girl, especially in that time. And I do sympathize with her, but also it's just like, I love Ruthie and Sylvie so much that I can't imagine abandoning them.
I know. I think, but you know, what I love again about this film is that Marilyn Robinson doesn't judge Lucille for making that choice. Lucille says, you know, you can't help be who you are. And Ruthie says, you can't help being who you are.
Yeah. You know, I love that line.
No judgment. It's, but you know, it is clearly the choice that I would make would be to follow Sylvie for sure.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Definitely.
Yep.
Definitely.
I just checked too on Sarah and Andrea. It looks like they had a couple credits afterwards and then it seems like they haven't done anything recently.
Oh, well, they should have. I mean, if they wanted to, they chose not to do it. So, but they certainly have talent.
They both have that great, just discovered actor feel too, where it's like they're not very trained and it just comes across very authentic and lived in, and they're just believable.
They are. They're very believable.
Yeah, they were so well cast. And again, you know, we did so much improv that I think that just helped them just live in their characters more.
I have a question. You mentioned improv. Is the scene where Sylvie is telling Ruthie about the place that she's discovered and she's saying, I want to take you there, was that improvised? Because we just watched it when we were recording.
It's in the book.
Is it really? Just the way that Ruthie's delivering the line, it feels very natural. So I wouldn't be surprised. Because she's like, well, that's the test I'm studying for. That's on Monday.
Right. No, that's all. I mean, I have to say the finished product, I don't think there's anything improvised. It was all scripted. What I mean is maybe a line or two that
people
want us to use, but mostly it was just to help us in rehearsal, just to find the scenes and figure out what our objectives were in the scene, what we wanted, what we needed. It's an exercise I always use when I'm teaching acting classes, is to just use your own words, use the circumstances of the scene, but use your own words. And then you can find out what your objective is, what you're really going for.
I love that. So there's a question about that whole sequence that follows that, where Sylvie takes Ruth across the water and they go up to that house with the frost. And Sylvie's talking about the children and how she's put marshmallows on trees and she's trying to catch one. And my argument earlier was like, I was completely with Sylvie until that point. Not that I'm not with her after that, but that's like the first inkling of like, oh, wait a second, where you kind of take pause of just in terms of Sylvie's intentions. Like, is she kind of, I guess there's two ways to look at it. She could be kind of creating this magical world for Ruthie, but I feel like it's more just like she believes this, that there are people living in the mountains in these houses and stuff. Like, what a cool, eerie, otherworldly scene. That the whole sequence is just amazing.
Yeah, I think that she might really believe in spirits, and especially the idea of children being, you know, living out in the wild, because she lives out in the wild and she imagines in a beautiful way that there are children who have escaped the jail, the straitjackets of conformity, and are able to live out in magical places with freedom. And, there's something that she says, it's better to have nothing. It's better to have nothing. So because Ruthie's saying, ooh, why would any child want to live in this kind of horrible shack in the middle of nowhere? And I think Sylvie's response was that these children, it's better to have nothing. It's better to have nothing, because if you have to sacrifice your freedom, there's nothing that's, more important. So that is the prize. Your freedom is the prize. And if you live in a shack, who cares? Because at least you have your freedom. But I think she does see and imagine spirits. And I think, whether or not they're real is sort of beside the point. She sees them, she feels them, she's inspired by them. And she hopes that her niece can see them. Maybe her niece can see them and she can't. Maybe her niece has some magical powers that she's hoping she has, and Sylvie hasn't quite been able to, to access yet. So I don't know, but I think it's all a positive thing that she's hoping that her niece experiences.
Yeah, I love that.
I think so too. How was the house burning like? Actually, I just thought of that. What was that like?
Well, I think all we did was just have the broom on fire and then light something and then hightail it out of there. I think that was probably done, in post, where they, burned the house down. Or I think when I look back, there wasn't really a burning house. They probably put that in later. Yeah. But it wasn't scary at all.
Okay. That's good.
So cool. Well, yeah, this is just such a lovely film that I hope just continues to grow and grow its audience and live on for years to come. It's just so beautiful and nuanced and special. It's really unlike any other film. And I think it's timeless. It's timeless.
I agree. And I guess, again, watching it today, I just thought it is such a feminist masterpiece. It just says everything about conformity and even when Sylvie says to Ruthie, when she's trying to get her to straighten up and so that she doesn't, they don't split up the family, she says smile, they like that. Women are always told they have to smile, and Sylvie doesn't give a shit about that. Doesn't give a shit that Ruthie never smiles, like who gives a shit? But she knows that that's like, oh, that's a key to to how women get through life, is you must smile.
One of my all-time, probably my favorite thing that Sylvie says is when she's talking to those ladies from church who say Ruthie looks sad, and Sylvie says, she is sad. Yeah, why shouldn't she be sad? It's perfectly summed up in that.
I think so too. It's something that I believe in my heart, Christine, that sadness is not to be hidden or shied away from. It's as much a part of life as joy, and to try to repress it or pretend that you're not is silly. Sadness means that you care. Sadness means that you have deep emotion. It's to be not celebrated, I think, in a way. Not like, woohoo, I'm sad, but that's
what Sylvie says.
Yeah, it's to be honored. And this little girl, her mother abandoned her and killed herself without a goodbye, left her with her grandma, and then left her with these two aunts who were like a brilliant cast, like two insects, just like such worry warts. And of course she's sad.
Yeah.
She lost her sister. Her sister's like rejected her. Yeah. She's sad. And the women are like, oh, no. They can't be sad. Girls, children can't be sad.
Yeah.
We were talking too about how the balancing act, again, it's in Marilynne Robinson's book, but it's in the film, it's just a lot of really sad things happen, but it's to the story's credit that you don't get bogged down. It's not really depressing. Like, these bad things are happening, but the movie has this gentle kind of touch to it where it never like overwhelms you or anything.
No, I think the tragic stuff is dealt with in just as much of a reality of life. It's mm-hmm. not, you know, tragic. It's sad.
Yeah.
Right. So it's like, as when to me, it reminds me of when Lucille is sweeping the cans and stuff in the water into the closet, trying to get rid of it. And then just the force of the stuff makes the door come open. And it all comes back out again.
Yeah.
I love that.
It's just a part of life. It's inevitable. And it is, you can't tuck it away. It's just, it is what it is. Yeah.
I love it all. Thank you, Christine. This was fantastic. Such a delight talking to you.
Yeah.
And we really appreciate it.
Yeah.
Thank you. I so appreciate that you're doing this. And I as I said, I'm so grateful that more people will know about this film thanks to you guys. And
fingers crossed. That's our goal.
It's your mission in life. Yeah.
Yes.
Good.
The more the better.
Yes.
I agree.
Well, thank you so much for your time.
I can't wait to hear this.
Yay.
Yeah, and thank you for doing this.
So awesome.
That was incredible. I loved talking to her.
I loved talking to her too. I loved everything she had to say. I loved that she watched the movie right before talking to us. I think that's so sweet.
Yeah. And I love how passionate she still is about the film.
Who wouldn't be?
Yeah.
It's such a great movie.
Anyway, this has been a pleasure. This has been our housekeeping episode.
If you haven't seen Housekeeping, tell your friends, watch it and enjoy it. Watch it with your parents. Watch it with your friends. Watch it with your boyfriends. Watch it with your girlfriends. Watch it with everyone.
I'm assuming if they've listened to this episode, they've seen the movie.
I'm on a mission here, okay?
But yeah, this movie's incredible. Great. Just great stuff.
Until next time.
I'm Greg.
I'm Jackie.
See you next week.
Bye.
This has been an official podcast of the Arroyo Film Club. Seen and Heard is Jacqueline Pistagian and Greg Kleinschmidt. Theme music by Andrew Cox. You can find us at seenandheardpod.com.